So the purpose of this segment is putting an end to war, and that is by examining the direct causes of war kind of in a mechanical way. And I think putting an end to war is a realistic goal. So the anti-war faction says that at least the last 10 or 20 wars were started by certain organizations of people or forms of organization that we can identify and we can see, and it's pretty blatant. And so we ask just exactly how do we stop these particular, not individuals, but the types of transactions and organization and behavior so that we can stop wars. So the first assertion that I want to make is that the MIC, Military-Industrial Congressional Complex, is a real thing. It is not a Rorschach test where it's a projection of your beliefs or anything like that. And it's not a conspiracy theory that was dreamed up by the Democratic Party to get more votes or anything like that. And it's not a way of looking at things. It's one of the great industrial complexes, I use the term great in the meaning of large, of which we have the telecom industry is sort of the granddaddy of regulatory capture. And we have agribusiness, we have media. Education is also an industry. It has many millions of people. And you have the transportation industry and so on. All of them have a government aspect. They have government protections of their monopoly, you could say, or regulation. And but the military-industrial complex is unique in that it has pretty much won the ball game and it's captured all the revenue. You sort of notice that when you look at the federal budget. And so it has a uniquely large portion of its money coming from someone else besides its own. It doesn't deliver value to anybody. What you really have is a bunch of folks saying, oh, I'll do a favor for you, I'll do a favor for you, and the money rains down from the taxpayers. So it's really kind of an odd industry. So I'm going to say my second assertion really is that the MIC is a cause of war. It's not something that just is a servant of the public or something that we need to have so we'll have a strong defense when the time comes. It's actually a cause of war. And one of the ways in logic and reason that you determine if something's a cause is if you take it away and then the phenomenon disappears after you take it away. Think about that for a while. It hasn't ever been taken away, so you can't prove that it's a cause. But I'll bet you, if you took away the military-industrial complex, you wouldn't have war. As Chalmers Johnson says in all of his speeches, when war is this profitable, you're going to see a lot more of it. The MIC is the cause of a lot of other things besides war. It's mostly about making money for its participants. Corporations, the nature of business is that the costs you don't have to pay that aren't on your expenses are somebody else's cost. And so a company will gladly create $1,000 of useless commotion of any kind. It doesn't matter, any arbitrary thing, any whimsical thing, as long as they can get a dollar of profit. And they can get down the road with that. In fact, you know, 200 years ago, the machines took over most of the physical work. And about 50 years ago and on, the machines took over most of the mental work. Well, what other kind of work is there? There isn't any. 95% of what we're doing is art. We could be laying out in the grass, and the same food would be on our table. It's pathetic. So war is our art, sad to say. So anyway, I define the MIC as a web of economic transactions. I worked for 20 years as a CPA in corporate accounting and finance, and I apologize for this. But what we know in accounting is transactions, and that is reciprocal transactions. People do things for other people for money. And so you have goods and services of all kinds and money. That's the classic element. But more commonly in the MIC is just goods and services in exchange for goods and services, by which I mean patronage and favors. So it's kind of like a big mutual back-scratching thing. Or as Chuck Spinney says in his film Inside the Pentagon, the self-licking ice cream cone. Has anybody seen that? It's a great video. So anyway, a key point I have to make on transactions. In business, transactions have a life cycle that starts with the negotiation and so on, and then there's a contract, there's a commitment, and then there's the fulfillment or the execution of the contract. So a transaction, you think of it as just a transaction, you know, and it takes place at a point in time. That's not how any transactions work. They're always, there's a life cycle of transactions, and it's well supported in business software. So what we're trying to do is to get back to those earlier stages of these contracts where it's relatively easy to change them. For example, when corporations need to change their relationships or their transactions relating to a factory, for example, they just budget a couple of years out and they shut that puppy down and everybody's out there and they can't do anything about it and it's over. All right? Or if they want to start up a new industry, they just crank the handle in the investment banking to get the money, start a new industry. this is where you have to be, is at the front end of these relationships, in the discussion stage, in the budgeting. In the corporation budget is what I'm talking about, not the federal budget. The federal budget is captured. But corporations are capable of changing. That's all I'm saying. They can change. How to make them change is, I haven't got time. Antonia is the expert on this. She's just taking them apart. Be sure to get out there and read the books, Chalmers, Johnson, Antonia's book. And this is a classic here. So with no further ado, Antonia Juhas.
Thanks, Todd. Hi. I want to thank Todd for all of his wonderful efforts in getting me here. I'm absolutely thrilled to be here. I was just on the phone with my father, who is a vet, telling him that he needed to be here with me. And he's in New Orleans right now working on reconstruction in New Orleans, not with the companies. He's an environmental design architect helping with local reconstruction. But so he couldn't be here. But I am absolutely thrilled to be here. So thank you for having me. I am with a group called the Institute for Policy Studies, and it's based in Washington, D.C., but I get to be in San Francisco, so I came up yesterday in the midst of all the hair gel scare to be here from San Francisco, and I'm very, very glad I made it, and my hair gel made it too, so I'm feeling good. I used to work for a group called the International Forum on Globalization for 5 years, and before that I worked for Congress, and I'm part of the military-industrial congressional complex, but I worked for Congressman John Conyers, and thank you. I'll just stay up here, sorry, thanks. And part of my job was working on military issues for Congressman Conyers, which meant battling head-on the military-industrial complex. So it was quite a good position to be in. But also, my work for Congressman Conyers started on domestic social policy, so welfare, job training, health care, social security. This was during the Clinton administration, so what that mostly meant was trying to fight the Clinton welfare reform bill, which meant for our constituents in Detroit, the largest welfare recipient population in the country, that they were all going to be cut off of the rolls. And when we lost, and they were cut off, I received all the individual phone calls from all the women across Detroit who wanted to know what we were going to do to help them now that they couldn't afford to provide food for their children or housing for their families. And needless to say, my policy attention quickly turned to alternatives and the looking for what we could do differently. And that took me to looking at community development block grants, which, to make a long story short, threw me right into the head of an international trade agreement that essentially would make it impossible for us to implement a community development block grant in Detroit. And this made me question what I was doing and say, well, if multinational corporations can just leapfrog us and go to the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development or go to the World Trade Organization or go to these mumbo-jumbo names of organizations that only five people in Washington know what they mean, then how am I going to be able to do the work that I want to do on a domestic level to really help my country? And I decided that what I needed to do was focus on international trade and investment rules and stopping the policies that were being implemented and work towards the implementation of alternatives. What these policies are called in the shorthand is free trade. Sounds really good. Most people in Seattle know more about the ills of free trade than probably most people. But free trade has all the same connotations and wonderful feelings of freedom, but the term is just as misused as freedom is by those who use the term free trade. And what I learned very quickly was that under the guise of so-called free trade, a lot of very brutal and deadly policies were being implemented. So when the Bush administration announced just 10 days after September 11th that it would be countering terror with trade, I knew that something very disturbing was about to take place if I didn't know it before when the Bush administration came into office. And the more I started looking, the more I identified what we're calling the structural causes of war, the structural motivations behind this administration, And the title of my book is The Bush Agenda, Invading the World One Economy at a Time. It doesn't give the credit to George W. Bush. What it points to is a series of long-term thinking among key political leaders on military and economic ideas that coalesced and have thus far reached their pinnacle during this administration. And therefore, I call it the Bush Agenda. But they certainly have no interest in it ending with this administration. It certainly didn't begin with this administration. And what it is unique to the modern era, the coalescing of the overuse of the U.S. military to accomplish a very clear economic agenda. And that economic agenda has everything to do with free trade, but what that free trade means is the interests of the largest multinational corporations, not all multinational corporations, not all U.S. corporations, but a subset that is intimately linked with this administration in a way that, again, is unique in the modern era. And by understanding the links between these specific companies and this administration and this war in Iraq, because now we have more than one war that the United States is involved in, this war in Iraq, the rest of the wars that are happening right now in the Middle East that the U.S. is party to through Israel, and the larger interest through the rest of the Middle East, the better that we can unravel that agenda, stop the war, stop the Bush administration, and stop the incursion of these corporations, which I absolutely 100% believe we can do, and I believe it's the people in this room that are going to have the most effect with that, because as Todd said, I think in the end of the day, it's getting this information more than anything else to potential military recruits, to soldiers that are currently serving in the war, that will shine that light that might not already be lighting that aha light to say, no way, as if I could quote, Cindy Sheehan on the back of my book, who wrote, all potential military recruits should read this book and then decide if Halliburton and Chevron are worth fighting for. I think that's a pretty simple way of putting it. So I'm going to provide a little bit of this picture. I'm going to talk for a little bit longer, and then we're going to have a lot of time for questions, because I'm going to probably present, I'm hoping that I will present a lot of information that I would hope that we have a discussion about afterwards, particularly targeted towards what we do about it. There are four corporations that I focus on in particular: Bechtel, which is based in San Francisco, which is a family-owned business that traces its history back about 120 years. I'll get back to Bechtel. Bechtel, which is the largest construction and engineering company in the United States and one of the largest in the world. Lockheed Martin. We all know who Lockheed Martin is. Lockheed Martin also happens to have 16 former or current executives who serve in the Bush administration. It's an unqualified umbilical link between one company and the administration. Lockheed Martin, in Todd's chart, the constant revolving door between Lockheed Martin and the current administration is particularly unique and strong, including Vice President Cheney's wife, who served on the board of Lockheed Martin. Lynn Cheney. Then there is Chevron. Chevron is easily forgotten because it's got its big, big daddy, ExxonMobil. And ExxonMobil is very important for us to focus on, given the fact that ExxonMobil over the last 2 years earned the largest profits of any corporation in world history. And that was in 2004 and 2005. In the first quarter of 2006, they earned 34% more than they earned in the same period in 2005, which means that they are set to, I mean, the profits they are about to make are astronomical. And that is part and parcel to what I'm going to talk about, but I focus on Chevron for several reasons, the most important being Chevron's very long and active history in Iraq, and in addition, of course, Ms. Condoleezza Rice, who it is very famously known that Condoleezza Rice has a Chevron oil tanker named after her. It's very less well known that she earned it. She spent 10 years on the board of directors of Chevron, and she was the head of their policymaking committee. She's intimately connected to this corporation, and its interests are intimately connected to her interests. The other company is, of course, Halliburton. And Halliburton's connections to Cheney are obviously well known. But what's less well known is, again, the umbilical link between Halliburton and the Bush administration. Because when Cheney was defense secretary for the prior Bush administration, he left that position to run Halliburton. He took a number of his leading compatriots from the senior Bush administration with him to Halliburton. He also took a tremendous amount of the Pentagon's budget with him and transferred an enormous amount of money that was once in the Pentagon budget that then got privatized into Halliburton's budget. Then when he came back to Bush Jr.'s administration, he again brought an enormous number of his Halliburton officials back into government with him, so that in essence you can see that the Bush administration is sort of a both Bush administrations and Halliburton is just sister cousins to each other as they, you know, open one door and now I'm in the administration and another door and now I'm in the Halliburton headquarters. I pick these four companies because of their link to the Bush administration, but also because of their very long history in Iraq. And by looking at their history in Iraq and then their influence on the various Bush administrations and their influence on what was and then no longer was the Saddam Hussein regime, we understand quite a bit about why we're in Iraq and why we're not getting out yet. These industries, weapons, oil and gas, and engineering are all obviously very intimately connected themselves, and they're a infrastructure hybrid for what the Bush administration needs to carry its economic interests forward around the world. So it needs oil companies, it needs engineering companies, and obviously it needs weapons. But the companies very much need the Bush administration to advance their access to oil, to engineering contracts, to wars in which they can supply lots and lots of weapons. And obviously the two work together. It's not a coincidence that the two work together. So this is the first time in American history that the president, vice president, and secretary of state are all former oil or energy company officials. In fact, both President Bush and Condoleezza Rice have more experience running oil companies than they do working for the government. Bush wasn't very government good at it, but he's not a very good president either. He wasn't hired for his expertise. He was hired for his connections in both cases. And the oil and gas industry has in turn been very, very friendly to the Bush administration. So the oil and gas industry donated 13 times more money to the Bush administration in the 2000 election, 13 times more than their challengers. And in essence, they've gotten what they've paid for, and they is a very relative term in this context, right? They includes the Bush administration, and they includes the oil and gas industry. They have gotten deregulation, the ability to vertically integrate, and you can't underestimate what this means. So the same companies now, because of vertical integration, control exploration of oil, production of oil, refining, marketing, and sales. In fact, the top five oil companies, or is it 10? It's in my book. Guess we're going to have to read my book. Either the top five or 10 largest oil companies in the world, I think it's five, produce more oil every day than Saudi Arabia exports. They control supply, but more important than that, they control refining capacity, which means they control how much oil gets turned into gas. So if you can control that, you can limit the supply of gas, and if you control the marketing and the pricing and the sales, then you can control price. The Bush administration has allowed that consolidation to happen and the deregulation, which allows it to be perpetuated, which increases the profits of its friends. But more importantly, it has fought a war for oil, and I'll explain how that works. But let me jump ahead to let's go a little bit back into the history in Iraq. So Ronald Reagan opened up the door to U.S. economic engagement with Iraq. Part of the initial impetus was to create a buffer in the war with Iran. So Iraq had launched a war against Iran. It was a brutal 8-year-long war. The United States had several interests. One of the interests was that we had had Iran, which had been the U.S. Oil chum in the Middle East after Saudi Arabia. And then Iran, you know, for those of you who are too young to remember, President Carter celebrated New Year's Eve 1977 with the Shah. We had a very nice, cozy relationship. Then there was this pesky revolution in Iran, and the United States got kicked out, and we no longer had that pool of oil. So Iran, the United States was looking for a new Iran, and it was looking to Iraq. So Ronald Reagan provided weapons to Saddam Hussein. He provided intelligence to Saddam Hussein in the war with Iran. And U.S. businesses lobbied aggressively for access into Saddam's market. And they did this through something called the U.S.-Iraq Business Forum, but also through Kissinger Associates. Our friend Kissinger just can't stay out of any modern history of the United States. And Kissinger Associates lobbied very heavily for U.S. businesses in Iraq as well. And those companies involved in that were Bechtel, KBR, part of Halliburton, Chevron, Exxon, you go through the list. George Shultz, who had been the president of Bechtel for 8 years, then became Ronald Reagan's Secretary of State. In that role, he personally lobbied with Saddam Hussein for increased U.S. business access into Iraq. And so did Donald Rumsfeld. The very famous picture of Donald Rumsfeld shaking hands with Saddam Hussein took place when Rumsfeld was Reagan's Middle East envoy, and he was there on behalf of several business interests, including Bechtel. And what the U.S. government wanted was for Saddam Hussein to sign a contract with Bechtel so that Bechtel could build an oil pipeline to get Saddam's oil out through the port of Aqaba, Jordan. While those negotiations were going on, though, Bechtel moved forward with managing a petrochemical complex for Saddam Hussein, which made the precursor to mustard gas, which was clearly used by Saddam Hussein. George Shultz worked very closely with Saddam. U.S. businesses worked very closely with Saddam. I'm going to fast forward through the story just to say they were all there. They were all working with him. They were all making a profit off of him while they could. George Bush Sr. pushed the envelope even farther and worked way more aggressively than Ronald Reagan to increase U.S. economic and corporate ties with Saddam Hussein, trying to get greater and greater access to Iraq's oil in particular, which, in fact, George Bush Sr. Did. He accomplished a tremendous amount of U.S. exports of Iraqi oil, and much of that was done by Chevron. However, Saddam wouldn't really play ball all the way. He wouldn't sign Bechtel's oil pipeline deal. He wouldn't open up his oil to the extent that U.S. companies and the Bush senior administration wanted. And he went ahead and invaded Kuwait. The lack of interest in continuing to work with Saddam Hussein sort of reaches its pinnacle at that point for the Bush administration. I'm not going to debate right now, and we can in questions, did Bush want Saddam to invade Kuwait? Did he let him? Why didn't he take him down afterwards? I'm going to sort of jump forward through that whole discussion because it's a big one and just say he wasn't playing ball with us the way our companies and our political interests wanted. Leapfrog forward to, again, now it's 10 days into the current Bush administration. And Dick Cheney has a meeting called the Cheney Energy Task Force. And we only know about the Cheney Energy Task Force because there was a Supreme Court ruling that forced only some of the findings to be made public. But we do know who was there. Bechtel was there. Halliburton was there. Chevron was there. Exxon was there. And they were these guys were designing our new national energy policy. So part of that new national energy policy was a chart, and under the heading of we need to gain greater access to Middle East oil, was a chart that laid out all of the foreign companies that had contracts for Iraq's oil. So if you'll recall, this is the sanctions period when the United States had sanctions against Iraq, when the whole world had sanctions against Iraq, most of it because of the United Nations. And Saddam Hussein was signing oil contracts with lots of companies from all around the world, but none of them could come into force while the sanctions were in place. The reason for signing the contracts, however, was because global public opinion was aggressively against the sanctions. The more that people learned about the brutal impact of the sanctions, the more likely it was that the sanctions were going to be eliminated. If the sanctions were eliminated, all of those other foreign companies were going to get access to all that oil, and the United States was going to be cut out. So we invaded, and it is an absolute fallacy that there was no post-invasion plan for Iraq. There was a very clear plan. It was an economic plan. It was written by a company called Bearing Point, Inc. They're based in Virginia. They had a $250 million contract to rebuild Iraq's economy. That plan was then put into place to a T by L. Paul Bremer, earning the name the new dictator of Iraq after about a month on the ground. He was the head of the U.S. the U.S. occupation government of Iraq, the Coalition Provisional Authority. In that position, one of the things he did was name a man named Bara Alum to become one of the first oil ministers of Iraq. Back to before the war. Before the war, a State Department group meets. It says, what should Iraq's oil infrastructure look like after the war? Let's think of something that would work for us really well. What the State Department comes up with is a plan that says that Iraq's oil should be, surprise, surprise, open to private foreign corporate investment on terms that are highly favorable to the private foreign companies. And more importantly, we really need to get rid of those pesky pre-existing contracts. So the first thing that Bara Alum does is cancel all those pesky pre-existing contracts. So the slate is cleared. And Paul Bremer implements a new economic agenda for Iraq. These policies, if you go back to the start of my talk, are just free trade, but, you know, with a neocon twist. A flat tax in Iraq, because they couldn't get one here, which would brought down the corporate income tax in Iraq from 40% to 15%, and brought up all taxes for all people who didn't have to pay taxes. They now had to pay 15% of their income. Things like making it impossible through a provision called national treatment for the Iraqis to give preference to Iraqi companies or workers in the reconstruction. So instead, 150 U.S. companies have received $50 billion for work in Iraq. The largest contracts have gone to Bechtel. Remember Bechtel back in our story? George Shultz now back on the board of directors of Bechtel. Bechtel gets $2.8 billion for reconstruction in Iraq. Parsons, Fluor, Shaw, these names should all sound familiar to anyone who is paying attention to reconstruction in New Orleans. Exact same companies. Exact same failure. A brand new report by the Special Inspector General for Iraq Reconstruction just came out, which cites tremendous, tremendous, tremendous failure on the part of U.S. companies. And I'm going to touch on this really quickly. So Bechtel gets $2.8 billion to rebuild water, electricity, sewage systems. Parsons, Shaw, they all get huge contracts. We only hear about Halliburton's contract, which we should, because at this point it's up to about $20 billion. But what the contract that is actually the most important to the people in Iraq and probably the most damaging to U.S. soldiers who have been and were operating in Iraq were the reconstruction contracts. Because this was billions and billions of dollars that went to U.S. companies without competition. They were cost plus, which meant that they were guaranteed their cost plus a fixed rate of return. They didn't do most of the reconstruction. According to the new report, only half of the projects in water, electricity, and sewage are complete. A full third in electricity didn't even begin. 3.5 years later, right? We've paid out $15 billion. And the Iraqis, let me back up again, two Bremer orders. One Bremer order fired 120,000 of all the ranking bureaucrats in the Iraqi ministries. These were the people who ran the water systems, the electricity systems, the healthcare systems, the education systems. They were fired because they would stand in the way of the reconstruction that the U.S. government had in mind. And, of course, the 500,000 Iraqi soldiers famously let go by Paul Bremer. What this meant was a tremendous increase in unemployment, but also people who the U.S. military had thought would do the reconstruction. That was part of the original idea of some of the smarter people, particularly soldiers in the military who were first charged with reconstruction, was that the soldiers, the former Iraqi soldiers, instead of taking their guns home to join the insurgency, would be given, you know, shovels and clipboards and would go to work doing the reconstruction. No. We've got American companies to do that. So the American companies came in and failed miserably. 3.5 years, electricity, water, sewage, still not at pre-war levels. In Baghdad, there's only 8 hours of electricity a day. There used to be 24 hours of electricity a day in Baghdad. Now, the people in Iraq were very unhappy about this. They needed the jobs. They needed to rebuild their country. They did it in 3 months after the last U.S. invasion of Iraq, and instead there were U.S. companies running around doing the work. This created, obviously, a tremendous amount of hostility and definitely has fed the violent resistance and the insurgency in Iraq. While the economic infrastructure was rebuilt, an oil law was slow, the one developed by the State Department, was slowly making its way through the Iraqi government. Now, the oil companies are smarter than the Bush administration. They knew, okay, the Bremer orders are illegal. They're illegal under international law. They're illegal under the Geneva Conventions, and I can explain that more later because I'm going to wrap up in 2 minutes. The oil companies knew that if the Bush administration went in and privatized the oil, that might be difficult. And so what they wanted was for an elected Iraqi government to pass a law which transformed the oil infrastructure so that they could sign legal contracts with a legal government and everything would be kosher. So this oil law has been shepherded through the Iraqi government through several Bremer appointees. Abdel Mahdi, who's the current vice president, the former prime minister, Ayed Alawi, shepherded this law through. It's now about 2 months from passage, according to the new oil minister of Iraq. The U.S. government and U.S. oil companies are heavily involved in ensuring that that happens. Once the oil law is passed, U.S. oil companies can sign contracts, but they're going to need security to get to work. What's the best security force in the world? 130,000 American troops. So I argue that the troops, unless we have quite a bit to say about it, are planned to stay there until this economic agenda is fulfilled. Now, real quickly, the rest of the agenda. 1 month after the invasion, the Bush administration announced plans for a U.S. Middle East free trade area, which would expand the economic agenda across the Middle East. With the threat of the Iraq war looming over the governments of the Middle East, these agreements are moving ahead at lightning speed. And this will open up the rest of the region, and already is, to foreign corporate advancement, with the ever-present threat of some sort of U.S. military action always present. Now, a couple things. The positive side of all of this is that for 3.5 years, while the U.S. corporate agenda has moved forward in Iraq, so has the anti-U.S. corporate agenda lobbied and worked very, very aggressively against this process. Yay. So I know I personally have protested in front of more corporations and been arrested in front of more corporations in the last 3 years than I can. Well, not that I can count. It's 4 times, but that I've been arrested. That this is a very alive force, and it has had an impact. So Bechtel Corporation, which has been protested against time and time again, did not seek new contracts in Iraq because it couldn't hand any more of this of the public pressure on it. Halliburton recently lost its huge cash cow, the log cap contract. That is through public pressure. That is a $20 billion contract. Do you think that Cheney wanted to cut a $20 billion contract from Halliburton? Hell no. Halliburton had to pay, and the way that it is paid through public pressure and congressional pressure is that that huge contract was canceled. In addition, the Special Inspector General for Iraq Reconstruction is now, finally, after 3.5 years, looking at each of these individual contracts in Iraq and looking at the failure of individual companies. And because of that, they just canceled a $50 million contract that Bechtel had to build a hospital in Basra that it's held for 3.5 years that it just hasn't built, just hasn't done it. So So the answer on the contracts is, one, to keep up the pressure, two, to demand that all of the U.S. contracts are canceled, that the money is returned, and most importantly, that all of the money goes to Iraqi companies. There are hundreds and hundreds of public and private companies that are more than capable of doing this work, that are ready to do the work, that have done the work before, that if they held the contracts themselves, would be able to do the work, and as experience has shown in Iraq, do it far more cheaply than U.S. companies are able to do it. And that also experience has shown that insurgents do not attack the work of contracts held by Iraqi companies when they're at work, and that the target is at contracts that are held by U.S. companies, even if it's Iraqi workers. Okay, that aside. Also, you know, as I said in the beginning, most importantly, I have met with many, many U.S. veterans from Iraq who have said that it's through reading and through learning, in addition to their experiences in Iraq, but learning about the corporate interests, learning about this larger agenda, that has helped edify them on the need and on the words to say to explain why they don't want to fight, why other people shouldn't fight, and that the information needs to be spread to exist. Soldiers aren't there to fight, then obviously there won't be a war. And if the corporations can't make a profit off of the war, there won't be a war. And if we continue to hold the companies to account, our elected officials to account, there are good ones. Remember John Conyers, who I spoke about? He's in there. There are good ones in there, and they're pushing, and they are making a difference, but obviously we can't just count on them. So we can talk more about solutions, organizing that we can do, organizing that everyone can do, and I really look forward to your questions and the discussion. I have a website. It's thebushagenda.net, and thank you all very, very, very much for coming out.
So now is your chance. We have our Q&A session, and I know that everyone has opinions on the military-industrial complex.
Thanks for the questions, and on the next slew of questions, I am going to encourage some women to please stand up and ask some questions. I know you have them. Just come up and ask. Okay. The Project for the New American Century, I failed to mention, by the way, that I have books here, and I'm going to sign them. And I came up, you made me think of it, because I have a very large focus in the book on the Project for the New American Century. Okay, raise your hand if you know about the Project for the New American Century. Please do. Okay, I don't have to explain it. One of the things I do have to say, though, is that I think it's important for us when we talk about the Project for the New American Century to repeat that there are 16, the same number as Lockheed Martin employees, 16 current members of the Bush administration that participated in the Project for the New American Century. So we don't just talk about it because, you know, it's a left-wing conspiracy. We talk about it because it's a full 16 members. It's Cheney, it's Rumsfeld, it's Wolfowitz, it's Zelik, it's Libby, it's Khalilzad. It's all of the guys who are making all of the decisions on this war and in this administration, and they laid out their interests very clearly in the writing of the Project for the New American Century, and therefore we should constantly be reminding the American public of what are in those documents. Those documents do, in fact, talk about economic issues, and what I try and do in the book is pull out of all of the sort of key documents that we talk about that are important documents, the National Security Strategy of 2002, Defense Planning Guidance of 1992, key documents, the economic aspects of the agenda. And basically what comes out very clearly is the desire, and they say it, is the desire to team, you know, the most expensive and most aggressive and most advanced military with the advancement of these economic interests. And that is the most clearly on display in Iraq, but certainly not the only place where this agenda can and will play out. So the question on Iran and the sort of larger strategic look into Iran, I'm not going to address all of that here. There's a very, very, very long strategic history of the U.S. in Iran, of the U.S. trying to get back into Iran. I think there are a lot of these guys that really think that Iran, is really the rightful property of the United States, and it, sort of passed off in that little revolution, but that, it really belongs back to us, and if for no other reason, then there's a heck of a lot of oil down there. That I do believe is quite clear that the administration is really intent on going to Iran, but the fact that it hasn't in an overt way yet is because of our activity. And I want to emphasize, Todd standing every weekend holding the banner, we can never, ever, ever underestimate the impact of those actions, of every weekend action, of every conversation that we have, of every protest that never makes it into the news. I don't know, you probably don't know that we shut down Bechtel's headquarters on Wednesday, but in San Francisco we did that. It's good. It was great. It didn't make any news coverage, but that's not the point. The people in Bechtel certainly knew about it, and we knew about it, and we then tell the story here, and then you then tell the story elsewhere, and we get it printed, and Dar writes about it, and then it gets on indie media, and that this is how, the revolution will be spread here. And we have to write the headlines of our victories, because they won't. And it is a victory right now that the Bush administration hasn't gone into Iran. And, we have to hold them to that. But we can't forget about Iraq. This is one of the things that I have found difficult in the last several weeks, which, of course, the horrendous activities of Israel in Lebanon and Gaza right now have to have a tremendous amount of our attention, but we can't not look at what's going on in Iraq at the same time, because they're slipping through a lot of these laws that I'm talking about right now, and it just happens to be at this moment when the world's attention is not looking at Iraq. The permanent bases, the permanent military bases are down to 4 right now, and the way that they're being advanced in Iraq is basically through a definitional game. So what does it mean to have a permanent military base? Well, I'm laying concrete on this base, but I'm just laying concrete because that will make it safer for U.S. soldiers in the facility right now. It's not to make it permanent. We'll take it up later. So the way they're sort of getting at building the bases is by a definitional exercise, and it is our responsibility to hold them accountable that the permanent military bases don't get built. I forgot something. Oh, the mercenaries. Do you mean to the extent of John Perkins' analysis of economic hitmen? Is that what you mean? We are not ever going to, in our lifetimes certainly, going to do away with those who have interests in making a profit off of wars, off of economic invasions, off of the suffering of others. And so there will be mercenaries and economic mercenaries. But what we can do is remove the institutions that support their activities, and we are doing that. So the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank have been deflated. It's like someone took a pin into them. It's not that they're not acting, but their ability to move forward their agenda has been dramatically. Same with the World Trade Organization. How did that happen? Well, part of it happened here, and it is through the pressure of social movements that the WTO, that the voices in the WTO that were contrary to the United States and the European Union and the Quad that they're called, have essentially made it function as a somewhat democratic institution, and therefore it doesn't work anymore. And Carlyle. Okay, real quick, because I want Todd to speak and I want other people to speak as well. Carlyle Group. I did not focus on the Carlyle Group. I think the Carlyle Group is very important, but I think that in this particular war that we're in right now, the upfront economic beneficiaries are a low-hanging fruit that we can get, and so we should. And we can expose these companies, and we can immediately reduce their ability to profit off of the war, and therefore we should. That doesn't mean that the other companies and infrastructure aren't important. It just means that I think we have to be focused and we have to have our victories. And I think that we can also, stop this war through a lot of this focus. Fascism, oh dear. Fascism, okay. Antonia, it's like a mind teaser game. Are they fascist? Yes, they're fascist. Of course they're fascist. Of course it's fascism. But to me, it's why I also don't say that is such a self-defeating word to me. You know, it's like this. It's like you make this label and you give them this power over you. You know, to me, it's really disempowering. And yes, but so what?
Right. I'd like to take a couple of whacks at this also. First, I wanted to respond to Marvin's comments about Alliant Tech Systems in Minneapolis and the actions that they're doing. And to me, this is hot. This is the way to do it. And incidentally, this campaign of stopping the merchants of death. Simon Herrick has been through here. Has anybody ever seen his PowerPoint? I mean, there are people who do the definitive PowerPoint on the military-industrial complex. He's one of them. You can go out into Google and do this sometime. Military-industrial congressional complex, in quotes, file type, PPT. And what you'll get is all the PowerPoints, and there's about 500 PowerPoints that people have done on the military-industrial complex. It is just a great way to do your research. And so Simon's, I was going to play his, you know, we haven't got that kind of time. But I'd certainly agree that it is fascism, and that was the original meaning of the word fascism. But as soon as you start using the word, the media has been there before us, you know. And there are three really cultural institutions. Let's not forget the educational system, which has been taken to some degree, and the pulpit. So without these three great reservoirs of knowledge and culture, human beings are nothing. I mean, we're helpless, you know. I mean, we'd just be as helpless as a turtle without a shell, because we are a mental and cooperating species. The repositories of our knowledge and our what we are as human beings are in these institutions. Everything that we do here today is lost in the background noise, because there's this great roar of 7 billion people going forward, and it's being guided by the institutions, you know. And just one more comment there was here. How do we stop the MIC from growing and taking over elections? There are at least 25 different ways that our elections and our democracy are really under attack. Everything from the gerrymandering trick in Texas, the corruption in elections, which predates voting machines. And there's a great campaign right now is to get the voting machines fixed. And then the other one is publicly financed campaigns. Thanks for your patience.
It's a wonderful strew of questions. Also, on my website, thebushagenda.net, you can email me, and I'm very happy to respond to emails and questions. Okay, I'm going to unfortunately sort of have to pick and choose, but some of these go together, and it's the sort of what we can do questions that has to do with the Democrats, that has to do with buying shares, boycotts. Here's what I think in terms of successful campaigning against the companies. You can act as a consumer, you can act as a stockholder, and you can act as a citizen of the United States who is represented by government officials. So there's several things we can do. I think one of the most important ways to undermine the power of the oil and gas corporations is to advocate as aggressively as possible for increased public spending on public transit so that people don't have to drive as much. It's one of the crucial missing links, particularly for folks in the middle class who say, oh, I just don't, you know, I just won't drive as much. People who are incredibly dependent on their cars for transportation really need public transit as an alternative option, and that's a government decision. We can implement a windfall profits tax on oil companies right now, and that money can be redirected immediately to public transit and to alternative fuels. Of course, we have to advocate, alternative fuels, use alternative fuels, consume less. I think boycotts are fine as long as it's very, very clear that you are providing really good information on why you're boycotting. And most importantly, is the boycott supported by the people who you're boycotting on behalf of? So let's say if we're boycotting on behalf of ending the Iraq war, you know, the Iraqi oil workers aren't calling for a boycott of Iraqi oil yet. They might if this law passes. They still need the sales of their oil. And so I think boycotting the oil companies becomes tricky. However, we also have very explicit interests, domestic interests, in protesting and boycotting the oil companies. So I leave that to you to debate among yourselves and in your own groups. I firmly advocate, I don't drive, I don't have a car. If you can do that, the best thing that you can do is not to use their product to your greatest extent possible, and do the things you need to do to make that possible. That means public transit. That means alternative fuels. That means fuel-efficient cars, working to increase fuel efficiency standards, working to increase the regulations on the oil and gas companies, to break up their monopolies in particular is one of another amazing thing that we can do, which will have a huge influence on the American democracy if there aren't companies that are ExxonMobil, Chevron, Texaco, Conoco, Phillips, right? These mergers have made these mega companies that have these mega profits, that have mega influence over our elected officials. Buy stock, yeah, totally. Stockholder action is very, very important. It's very influential. It's increasingly influential. And I encourage people to also participate on that level if you can. The Democrats, the Lamont victory is critically important for us to understand that we can, in fact, win, and win in a state like Ohio, which does have incredible issues of voter fraud and voter manipulation and control by the Republicans, but Lamont still won. And I think we can work on all of these fronts at the same time, or we can pick and choose. I think we can work for candidates that represent the issues that we want. We can campaign against the corporations. We can support soldiers that don't want to fight in the war. We can work as consumers, or we can do one of those things that feels right. I think we all also get stuck in this place, which is there's so much wrong. And we know, we're some of the lucky ones that know of all the great work that's going on, that we then get stymied and we say, wow, I really should be working here. I really should be working here. Have faith in the rest of the movement. You know, you're not alone. There are people working here and here and here. And where you are most effective is on the thing that really feels right to you, that you can communicate to your community, that you can work on every day and feel good about and feel proud about. And every once in a while, you're going to do other stuff in there too. But that makes us the most effective activists, I think. And so I'm just going to say really quickly, Israel. I believe that the United States is fighting a proxy war through Israel right now. I believe that... it is very much, you know, my colleague Phyllis Bennis at the Institute for Policy Studies is the goddess of everything Middle East. She is an expert. She is an activist. She is brilliant. She writes better than anyone on the planet. And she just puts out information every week about the conflict that you have to read. It's at the Institute for Policy Studies. But and she wrote very clearly in a recent piece about, you know, and it dovetails with my analysis in my book, which is the Bush administration has very clear hegemonic interests in the Middle East. They are about denying power to China and Russia as well. So if the United States has the oil, China doesn't. And the United States gets to decide when China gets it and under what terms, right? That's another way of containing geopolitical power. Shout it out.
I think China's going to pull the economic plug on us and we won't have any longer.
It's possible. Our economic interests are dovetailing more and more and more, though their economic interests are dovetailing more and more. Oil is not just about oil company profits. Oil is about geopolitical control. And the Bush administration and U.S. governments for a very long time have felt this need and have said that they would use the U.S. Military to advance our interest to the U.S. interest to protect their government's interest to protect access to the region's oil. What is unique about this administration in modern American history is the desire not just to prop up dictators that would support U.S. access, but go in, rewrite the laws, lock in the economic interests of U.S. corporations to gain as much access as possible. And this is where the oil law comes in. The oil law, as I said in the beginning of the presentation, in Iraq is set to be passed in approximately 2 months' time. What we can demand is, one, that the U.S. government should not have any say whatsoever over the new oil infrastructure of Iraq. if we do, that makes it a little bit painfully clear as to why we went in the first place, right? That we can cancel contracts, for example, for companies like Bearing Point. One of the things that Bearing Point is still doing on the ground in Iraq is advising on the new oil law. That contract should be canceled and Bearing Point should be brought home. We can demand the end of the military occupation of Iraq will tremendously alter this economic equation. So when we fight and when we demand that the troops be brought home, we are also demanding an end to the economic invasion as well. And that will go a long way towards ending the ability of the new oil law to have its control over Iraq, and could in fact open the door for the Iraqis to actually be making these decisions over their own oil, which is what the oil companies are demanding, oil workers are demanding in Iraq. I'm just going to end to say, please visit my website, thebushagenda.net, because I have links to a number of great organizations that are working on these issues that will be useful for you to have and useful for you to increase the dialogue. And I'm going to let Todd close us out, and thank you all for coming in, and I'm going to sign books.
Well, thank you very much, and that pretty well closes it out. I just want to make one more comment. It wouldn't be fair to myself if I didn't tell you my opinion about the boycott idea, and because 3 years ago, or 4 years ago now, when this thing came over the horizon, I thought it'd be a great idea if there was a general strike, and I looked at all my neighbors, and they weren't going on strike, and so I went on strike, and I quit working. I don't work anymore. I don't care about money, and I don't give a damn what anybody thinks. I'm not working at all, and I'm mad about it, and I'm not a happy camper. I haven't worked a day for a dollar since 2002, and I don't plan to work another day the rest of my life. I spent all my life savings. I burned my CPA license. It's all a bunch of corrupt, rotten crap, and you know it. There's a lot of you out there who feels the same way I feel. And people, guess what? I ran out of money, and guess what? People are feeding me. People give me money to buy food. I got rid of my car. I ride my bike everywhere. You know how much you need to live on? It's peanuts. You need one bowl of chili from Wendy's every day. That's a dollar. I count it up. You know how much is it? It's not hard to live in this country. Go on strike. Get everybody else to go on strike. Withhold your cooperation. Don't give your labor. Don't give your money. Take it all back. Take your money and convert it to yen and invest it, convert it to euros. Just totally go on strike. Boycott American products, okay? Don't boycott foreign products. This is where it's at. Just totally go on strike. Get as many people as you can to go on strike, okay? That's how you go on strike. You don't ask other people to go on strike.
Thanks, everybody.